Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eric Liu, who's the founder of Citizen University and the author of several books, including The Gardens of Democracy and The Accidental Asian. He previously served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton and has an article at CNN, How America is Rigged for the Rich. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Liu.
Ian, thank you for having me.
And Paul Ryan, the congressman who ran as vice president on the Republican vice presidential ticket in the last election, also has put forth the Republican budget. He has recently stated that he has a problem with the culture of poverty. You're arguing in your CNN piece that actually the real problem is the culture of concentrated wealth.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think the argument that Paul Ryan has been making recently about the so-called culture of poverty isn't a Paul Ryan original. There have been people for decades actually saying essentially that the reason why poor people in America are poor is that they have bad habits, bad values, and are part of a bad culture. And, you know, put aside for a moment the pure kind of blame the victim morality of that, the larger point that I'm trying to make right now is that we are living through this unbelievable, nearly unprecedented period of radical inequality, both income and wealth, and radical concentration of wealth and opportunity. And when you have this kind of concentration, where the, you know, it's not just what the 1% have, but it's now getting to really what the 0.1 and the 0.01% both have in terms of income and wealth, and the ability that they have to convert their outsized wealth into outsized voice in our politics, says to me that really the greater, deeper threat to our democracy, to our social cohesion, to our moral fabric, isn't the culture of poverty, if you even believe that exists. It's this culture of wealth that says that, hey, we should just be completely every man for himself, and a few people end up hoarding you know, the great gains. If 400 families end up having more wealth than a million Americans, as is the case today, then so be it. And that, to me, is a far greater threat, both morally and practically, to the viability of our democracy than anything that's going on, as Paul Ryan focuses on, in our inner cities.
Well, it seems like Paul Ryan, who apparently has been heavily influenced by Ayn Rand's writings, and, of course, the Catholic nuns on the bus visited him in the last presidential election to test his Catholic faith, which he advertises in terms of his adherence to Ayn Rand's philosophies. But she's basically arguing that altruism is a sin and selfishness is a virtue. And it would seem that beating up on the poor or the least among us, you know, picking on the poor seems to be a cheap shot, when the real argument here, and I take it the one that you're putting forth, is that we have a rigged system where we don't have a level playing field. We don't have the Horatio Alger, pull yourself up kind of opportunities. We are no longer the land of opportunity. And that's the issue we should be addressing. And by beating up on the poor, you're basically changing the subject.
Well, you're not just changing the subject when you beat up on the poor. You actually are, you know, it's a classic case of what psychologists call projection, right? The things that often conservative critics of the poor say are characteristic of the quote-unquote culture of poverty are things like short-term thinking, you know, a lack of personal responsibility, unwillingness to play by social norms and rules, kind of scoffing at the idea of being of productive work, this kind of shameless materialism, and this inability to defer gratification, right? And you get a lot of people scolding poor inner city, often people of color, for exhibiting these things. And I'm not saying these patterns of behavior and these norms don't exist among the poor, but the great irony is that there is no better case study or exhibit for all of those dysfunctional values and those dysfunctional aspects of culture than on Wall Street today. You know, tribal insularity, short-term thinking, personal irresponsibility, this kind of, you know, avoidance of being productive contributors to society. And to me, I think there is this idea that it's bad enough that we're picking on those who are weakest and have the least. It's even worse that those doing the bullying are the very ones exhibiting the antisocial behaviors. And, you know, I think the larger point that you allude to here is the riggedness of the game, right? If we had a truly free market, indeed, if there could ever be such a thing as a truly free market, as if markets somehow were ordained by God before government existed, but if we had a truly fair market even, we wouldn't have a situation where the top 1% were able to triple their share of national income over the last three decades. That tripling, that concentration, is the predictable result of a deliberate effort to rig the rules of the game. Tax rules, subsidy rules, rules of policymaking, rules that treat some kind of income as taxable and others less so, and rules that over and over again favor unearned capital over hard-earned work. And that, to me, is something that is, again, not just morally repugnant. It's just stupid and self-destructive. It undermines our economy when you have that much of our nation's wealth and lifeblood concentrated in so few hands. And it also undermines our democracy.
Again, I'm speaking with Eric Liu, who's the founder of Citizens University and the author of several books, including The Gardens of Democracy and The Accidental Asian. He previously served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton and has an article at CNN, How America is Rigged for the Rich. Well, it seems, though, that much of these arguments don't, as you pointed out earlier, they don't just come from Paul Ryan. In many ways, they are a part of the Republican strategy, I think, to hold on to the so-called endangered white man, with afraid that the demographic shifts underway in this country are going to marginalize the white man, and the notion being that that somehow you can keep racism alive, in effect, by suggesting either in code or quite openly that welfare is for minorities, for lazy minorities. I mean, the subtext of much of the opposition to the Affordable Care Act is that we're going to have a bunch of freeloaders now on the government dime, on your dime, and it's going to cause your premiums to go up. And they've been very successful in framing that the Obamacare in that way. And the White House has been much less successful in pointing out the virtues of it. So clearly, this will be an election year topic. What can be done to undermine that constant message that I think is in many ways keeping racism alive?
Well, Ian, I think you're right in part, and I think there's also a part that's even bigger than this aspect. So the first thing I would say is that there's no question that we're in a time where so much of national politics, but particularly so much of Republican politics, is a reaction to these profound demographic shifts and the diminishment of the both numbers and actual cultural clout and political clout, relatively speaking, of the white electorate and white men in particular. The Republican Party nationally has thus far been making a bet that they can keep on squeezing votes out of a disaffected majority that is kind of beginning to foresee its minority status. In a short-term way, there is a certain amount of rationalism in that strategy. You can get people fired up in an angry, white, disaffected, alienated base. But number one, that's no long-term strategy for even building a majority party. And number two, it's certainly no strategy for actually unifying the country, right? Demographics are, to a great extent, destiny. Not that any Republican's asking me for advice, but frankly, if I were a Republican, I'd be pivoting in the direction of Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, who recently said, much to the dismay of many of his more extreme party colleagues, that if that party is going to be a going concern nationally in our politics over the next generation, they've got to learn in deed as well as word to become more inclusive and to really think about how they frame their aspirations and their policies in terms that are not pivoting off of and against a boogeyman of poor people of color, but actually find ways to make them part of the story. This goes to the second thing that I would say, Ian, which is, there's no question that race has always been and is today now being exploited in our politics, and that race is often used as this clumsy proxy for struggles that are going on of class. There is great class status anxiety in our country now in a shrinking middle class, and it's really easy to find race-colored scapegoats for that anxiety. The thing I'd say, though, to not to be just kind of monolithically partisan here, is that, quite frankly, Democrats, in many cases, have bought in as much as Republicans have in this notion that the way an economy becomes healthy, the way that we get prosperity, is to buy into a trickle-down vision that says if we take care of a few people at the top, their wealth will magically somehow leak down to the rest of us. Though Republicans have been the ones mainly advancing that idea, Democrats, either simply by default or by inattentiveness or by failure to posit an affirmative alternative, have essentially let it happen, and in some cases have actually bought into it whole hog. And I think, you know, to your bottom line question of what do we do, what do we, just the citizens and the listeners to this conversation, to start changing this, part of what we have to do is just question the explanations that are being peddled to us by people of both parties for how we actually build both a prosperous economy and an actual democracy. And the way we do that isn't by continuing to feed more and more into the hands of fewer and fewer people at the top. The way we build an economy and the way we revive a democracy is from the middle out, not the top down. And I think this middle out philosophy is something that we, certainly I as a progressive, feel like it's imperative right now to be pushing.
But isn't that, don't statistics bear it out, Eric Liu, that the majority of people in poverty, the majority of people on food stamps and welfare are, in fact, white?
Yeah, that is true. The majority and, there's no question that, first of all, the majority of people who are poor are white. And second of all, the majority of dollars that are being spent in this country on what you might call welfare are being spent on the rich, not the poor.
Sure. We have right-wing welfare. We're unique amongst the advanced democracies in that regard. Agribusiness, the military-industrial complex, it is pretty breathtaking.
But even just in the tax code, I mean, the way we have tax expenditures and tax preferences that are tilted overwhelmingly toward the already affluent, it would be fine if we had just a neutral system, but we have a system that actively is trying to feed more advantage and more wealth to those already with advantage and wealth in how we count things either as taxable or as shielded from tax.
So, Eric Liu, I must say that the Democrats' only strategy to win back, not that they're likely to win back the House, but at least to hold on to the Senate in this election year, seems to be to scapegoat the Koch brothers and blame them for everything. And there's no question that the Koch brothers are politically active, but they're not behind everything, as a lot of people think. And it would seem that that is a bankrupt policy. Why not come up with a real program to revive a level playing field, to revive entrepreneurship, to give the people in this country who aren't getting a fair shake a fair shake?
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, look, I'm no fan of the Koch brothers, but I think an electoral strategy built on demonizing them is implicitly an admission that your goal is to minimize your losses, right? They're just trying to get enough of a base activated, a base that already knows vaguely about who the Koch brothers are and gets exercised about the power they wield to show up at the polls to stop some of the expected bleeding in these midterm elections. But you're absolutely right that there is an affirmative case to be made, an affirmative argument for progressives to make about how from the middle out and from the bottom up we can actually rebuild this economy and get purchasing power and demand growing again and actually get opportunity flowing. And that is just a story that right now, particularly because many Democrats are just scared, and they're scared that they're going to lose, and they're scared that the Affordable Care Act is going to drag them down, which, by the way, I don't think it will. I think in a few months' time, it will be less toxic than it is today. And in a couple of years' time, people are going to be saying, do you remember back when the failure of the website for ACA originally made everybody think the whole thing was doomed? Gosh, that was crazy. That was back before we had 20 million people with insurance now and people buying into this and believing this. But in the short term, with midterm elections coming up in a few months, I think too many Democrats are operating out of fear and therefore, as you suggest, Ian, not really thinking first about how to put forward an affirmative story for why they should win.
So just in closing then, Eric Liu, is it a chicken and egg situation here? If we are losing our democracy and becoming more and more of a plutonomy or a plutocracy, and the Supreme Court has enabled their last couple of rulings, Citizens United and in particular McCutcheon, seem to suggest that somehow billionaires are beleaguered and they need special preference in elections, and therefore we have to open the floodgates entirely. And so given that if you create a political system that's based on money or is about money, then he who has the most money owns the most politics. So given that situation, what do you think can be done then to get to that program that we talked about, which is the need for a real program to rescue the middle class, to level the playing field, to allow entrepreneurship and the American dream not to be a slogan and a bankrupt slogan at that, but a reality?
Well, it's a great question, and this really goes to the work that I do with my organization, Citizen University. Our work is all about just re-empowering, indeed reawakening people to their often dormant power as citizens. I think there is a chicken and egg, or at least a vicious circle dynamic, where economic inequality begets political inequality, which begets more economic inequality, and after a while people feel voiceless and powerless, and they feel more like spectators, and they feel like, what's the point of showing up as a citizen? The reason why I don't think it's ultimately a chicken and egg thing is we can break it. We can actually break that cycle. And, you know, yes, our politics has gotten more rigged than ever before. And yes, the Supreme Court has just, you know, made it even easier for money to accelerate its grip on our politics. But at the end of the day, you know, there are hundreds of millions of us who actually have the right to vote. Only a, you know, less than a majority of us actually exercise that right. If the number who are eligible to vote voted in this country, then no amount of Koch brothers, no amount of, you know, plutocrats at the top could actually force through their policies. No, and their actions and choices and their rigging of today's game do not actually work to deny you and me the choice to say, you know what, today I'm actually going to vote. Today I'm actually going to get 10, 20, 30 other people I know to vote. You know, it sounds old-fashioned and corny, but it remains the most powerful, leveling, equalizing thing to do to exercise the franchise and to remember and, you know, by exercising the franchise, remember that in the end, there's 99% of us. and if we actually show up, we can change our politics.
Well, Eric Liu, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Liu, the founder of Citizens University and the author of several books, including The Gardens of Democracy and The Accidental Asian. He previously served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton and has an article at CNN, How America is Rigged for the Rich. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.